The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guest this evening. Since 2001, photojournalist Lindsay Addario has raced toward conflict zones in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Sudan. Her photographs do nothing to hide the horrors to which she bears witness, but they emphasize a shared humanity, a social responsibility too often neglected by those who can afford to ignore the world's cruelties. She compels viewers to see themselves on the other side of her lens, despite differences of race, gender, age, or nationality. She has shared her images with the world in publications like the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. Her many honors include a Pulitzer Prize for international reporting, and a MacArthur Fellowship, which she used to concentrate on maternal health and mortality. Her new book, Of Love and War, is a powerful showcase of her career and a visual testimony to the most pressing conflicts and humanitarian crises of the 21st century. The result is a stunning record of bravery and futility, resilience and oppression, hope and despair. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Lindsay Addario to the Free Library.
Thank you all for coming out. I will start with a short video.
The New York Times now says that four of its journalists reporting on the conflict in Libya have gone missing.
Four journalists, two reporters, and two photographers for the New York Times disappeared on Tuesday.
Editors say they have not heard from Anthony Shadid, Stephen Farrell, Tyler Hicks, and Lindsay Addario. Four New York Times journalists were held captive. They'd been reporting from the eastern city of Ajdabiya. The Times executive editor says the paper has been in contact with the Libyan government, and they were assured that the four would be released promptly if they had been captured.
Libyan authorities said the group was captured in eastern Libya last week by forces loyal to Colonel Gaddafi.
So a lot of people ask why I started covering war or how I had the tools to cover war, and I always start with a picture of my family. I was born in Connecticut, the youngest of four sisters, and I think the best training ever to be a war photographer is to have three older sisters. So this is in the 70s, and my parents were hairdressers. And so when I was putting this book together, I had to figure out how to condense 23 years of shooting into a 270-page book. So I had bodies of work from over 60 countries. I've been covering conflict across the Middle East and Africa and humanitarian crises. So I met with a book designer in London, and we started looking through all the images and combing through them. And these are some of the images that didn't really fit in the rest of the book. This is juveniles in prison in Sierra Leone. And this was my first assignment for National Geographic magazine. In 2007, I started shooting in 2008, and it was on gross national happiness in Bhutan. So at that point, I had been covering war for almost a decade, and my first assignment was on happiness. So I wasn't really sure how to handle that. I covered the drought in 2011 in Kenya and Somalia, and I was actually photographing a food distribution, and I looked over and saw these children playing on the dead tree, and I immediately went over because it seemed like such a beautiful scene. This picture didn't make the cut of other images of the drought, but it's an image that stayed with me. And in 2003 and 4, I covered the war in Iraq, and I went back in 2009 and 10 to cover Baghdad coming back to life for National Geographic magazine. So you're looking at a 3D movie theater, which was, they called a 5D movie theater because it actually blew wind on people's faces and sprayed water. And these are all families watching that movie. So in 2000, I was a young woman. I was 26 years old, and I moved to India to try to become a photographer. And I was experimenting with different mediums. I was shooting negative. These are some early pictures from Afghanistan under the Taliban. I had a roommate at the time who was going in and out of Afghanistan under the Taliban, and he said to me, you know, you're a woman and you care about women's issues. Why don't you go to Afghanistan and photograph women? And it seemed like the most likely thing to do. So I made a few phone calls to the United Nations. I asked if they could help facilitate my trip. I also talked to a local landmine organization, and I borrowed some money from my sister. And the night, I had no money. And so the night before I was leaving for Afghanistan, I called my mother and I said, Mom, I'm going to Afghanistan tomorrow. She said, okay, honey, have a good time. Because she had no idea. Of course, this is before September 11th. So when I went there, I realized immediately that my gender was an asset, that as a woman, I can access women. I was working on the streets, even though photography of any living thing was illegal under the Taliban. So I had to sneak around with my cameras in a bag. I often worked with a panoramic camera that was hidden under my shawl. And I would take it out sort of very quickly, take a picture, and hide it again. In 2001, in March, I was working in western Afghanistan in Herat, and I heard there was a very bad drought that was going on there. And my driver said, you know, madam, I have to leave early today because there's a wedding. One of my brother's friends or a relative is getting married. And I said, great, take me with you. So we went. And in Kabul and in Afghanistan under the Taliban, the streets were silent. Music was illegal. Any form of entertainment was illegal. So it was really, when you walked on the streets, it was really eerie. So we went to this house, and I remember descending down these stairs in this home and hearing the soundtrack of the Titanic blasting. And there were these couples, this couple was dancing, and all these Afghan women with makeup and dancing and it was incredible. And this was really my first exposure to sort of the fact that life goes on in a war zone. And there's a whole world hidden behind people's, behind walls. In 2001, I asked the New York Times if I could go in and cover the fall of the Taliban in Kandahar. And I was assigned to work with the New York Times magazine. And we pulled up to the governor's mansion, and this was the scene out the car window. And I remember being terrified to jump out of the car. And I was working with Ruth Frempson, a New York Times photographer. She was there for the paper. And she just jumped out of the car and started shooting. And I said, okay, well, if she can do it, I'll jump out too. And I jumped out behind her. When a regime falls, there are these incredible scenes that we have access to that we wouldn't ordinarily have access to. We can get into prisons, intelligence offices, into government offices. And so this is a man who had been in prison for so long, he didn't even know the Taliban had come into power and had left power. And this was inside of a prison underground in Kandahar. In 2003, I wanted to cover the war in Iraq. It was very clear our country was gearing up for the war in Iraq. I didn't have any combat experience, so I decided not to do a military embed, but instead I went in through Iran into northern Iraq. There was a proxy war going on there. The Kurdish Peshmerga, backed by American special forces, were fighting Al-Ansar. That was a group linked to Al-Qaeda in the mountains in northern Iraq. About 6 weeks later, Saddam Hussein fell, and there were these unbelievable scenes of euphoria. People were defacing pictures of Saddam. They were trying to get back into their homes that they couldn't get into while the soldiers were making their way up through Iraq. But then the horrors of the war became unveiled. What you're looking at here is a mass grave. Every single one of these sheets is the body of someone who had disappeared under Saddam. Shiites were killed en masse under Saddam, and many families couldn't ever mourn openly. So when he fell from power, they came and unearthed the bodies and were able to grieve. After the fall of a regime, there's often chaos. People are looting everywhere, and that looting often leads to fires. So this woman was going to look for her husband in a factory fire, and I remember screaming out after her and saying, be careful, there could be secondary explosions. And she sort of looked at me and just kept walking. Often for the New York Times in 2003 and 4, there were explosions almost every day. There were suicide bombers going in, Iraqis were being killed, Americans were being killed. And as a journalist, the only way we can cover these things were to literally hear an explosion, run up to the roof of the New York Times building, look for the smoke, and try and get there. on some occasions when we were too late and a cordon had been set up, we had to go to the morgue. It was the only way to report on a story and to meet the family members. So on this particular day, there was a call for young Iraqis to sign up for the police force, and two suicide bombers went, and dozens of Iraqis were killed. So I went to the morgue with my driver, Hisham, and we were sitting on the sidewalk, and so many young Iraqis had been killed that they had run out of caskets in the city. So the father of this man sat next to me, and he was cursing the Americans and cursing the occupation and saying what had happened to his country and that he told his son not to leave the house that day. And so I introduced myself, and I said, "I'm so sorry about what happened. I'm American, and I'm sorry." And he said, "Do you want to see what your country has done?" And he pulled me into the morgue, and he pulled his son down and opened the sheet, and he said, "This is my son. I told him not to go for a job. I stole his car keys. I hid my own car keys." And he woke up at 5 a.m. and found them and went to apply for this job, and he died. He said, "Show your country." I started working with the American troops in 2003 and 4. Sometimes we went in the middle of the night. We'd go on raids in the Sunni Triangle and round up Iraqi men. Sometimes they put bags on their heads and zip ties on their wrists. And as journalists, we were able to photograph everything. The one thing I hadn't seen really in those few years were wounded American soldiers. So in 2004, Life magazine asked me to go and document the wounded coming out of Fallujah. What you're looking at is the inside of a C-17 cargo aircraft. There were so many wounded coming out of Fallujah that the military stripped the inside of the aircraft and put all of the wounded to fly to Germany like this, and that's where they were treated. This young man was also wounded in battle. He was a Marine, and he was being driven in a yellow school bus to that plane, one of those C-17 aircrafts, and that's how he was being flown to Ramstein. Now, I had never seen anything like this. I hadn't seen wounded soldiers. I spent about 6 days on the ground. I then flew back to the U.S., and I sent Life magazine all my photos. They held those pictures for about 5 months. This was November of 2004. And finally, in about February of 2005, I got an email from the photo editor of Life magazine, and she said, "I hate to tell you this, but we will never publish your pictures of wounded soldiers because my editor doesn't think the American public can handle them." Well, of course, I was furious because I said, "How dare you send me to war if you don't have the guts to publish what we see?" In 2009, I was working on a story on the medevacs. Those are the pilots and the team that goes into battle. They pick up the wounded and they bring them back for treatment. We had gotten a call for an Alpha. That's the most gravely wounded soldier. Within seconds, we jumped into the Black Hawk. Everything's pitch black. I had night vision goggles. And in the middle of the night, we flew in. It was a 3-minute flight. We picked up this young man and brought him back to the hospital. For 29 minutes, the medics and the Navy medics and worked on him and tried to resuscitate him. He had lost 9 pints of blood. They opened his chest, massaged his heart. Everyone in the room was silent. The room started filling up with soldiers and officers. And at one point, an officer said to me, "Stop taking pictures." And everyone else in the room stood up and said, "No, she needs to be here. The American public needs to see what's happening to our men." And so I continued photographing. It was very sensitive. And after 29 minutes, he passed away. I needed permission from the family to publish any photographs that showed his face or any distinguishing marks. So around 2 weeks later, I got a call from his father. And he said, "I understand you were with my son when he died. The only thing I know is that he was killed in combat operations in Afghanistan. Can you tell me everything? Can you tell me every single thing you remember about my son?" And I said, "You know, it's a very difficult conversation. I mean, how much detail do you want?" And he said, "I want to be with him every moment until he died." And of course, we had a 2-hour conversation where we both cried and we talked about everything. He wanted to know that everything was done to try to save his life. And it was very emotional. And in the end, The father decided that his other two children wouldn't be able to handle seeing the pictures of their brother. So they asked us not to publish with the identity revealed. And so this was one of the few photos that was published from that series at that time. And his other siblings only learned that this was their brother about a year ago. In 2007, I got an assignment from the New York Times Magazine to go with Elizabeth Rubin into the heart of the Korangal Valley. This was one of the most dangerous places in Afghanistan at the time. It was where the U.S. military was dropping the most bombs. We wanted to go to understand the rhythm of the war, why so many civilians were losing their life in Afghanistan. So we went to Jalalabad, that was the headquarters for the eastern region in Afghanistan, and Elizabeth and I went to the public affairs officer and said, hey, we'd like to go to the Korangal Valley. And he sort of looked at us and said, I don't know, it's not really a place that's fit for women. And we said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, there's no place for you to sleep and no place for you to go to the bathroom. And we said, well, that's funny, where do the men sleep and where do the men go to the bathroom? And he said, well, they sleep in bunkers on the side of the mountain. And we said, well, great, we can do that. So he said, okay, come back tomorrow. And we were very lucky because Colonel Ostlan, who was in charge of the Korangal, had a philosophy of transparency, and he believed in letting journalists in to witness the nuances of the war. So we flew in, and we ended up spending 2 months on the side of the mountain with those troops. We were in a six-day operation called Operation Rock Avalanche, where we jumped out of Blackhawks in the middle of the night into the heart of the insurgency. We walked for 6 days with everything we owned on our backs, sleeping bags, warm clothes. We spooned at night to stay warm. It was 7,000 feet in the mountains of Afghanistan in October. On the sixth day, we were ambushed by the Taliban and hit from three sides, and Sergeant Rugel was killed. You see his body here in the body bag. And so for this book, I went back and I interviewed Clenard, who's carrying him on the left. And I wanted to know what it was like for him that day. What did he remember? What is the meaning of a photograph to him? Does he feel anything when he looks at this photo? Because I know what happens to me when I see this photo, that I'm brought right back to that day. And this is the aftermath from that attack. A year later, I got a call from Dexter Filkins. Dexter was a colleague for the New York Times. He's now at the New Yorker. And Dexter and I have known each other for 18 years. And he, anyone who knows him knows that he calls people dude and man. He's very funny and he's very charismatic. And so he called me up one day and he said, hey man, I got the best story for us. It's on the Talibanization of Pakistan. And my husband, who was then my boyfriend, could hear Dexter's voice through the phone. And he said, you're not going to meet the Taliban. And I said, no, why would I do such a stupid thing? I would never go meet the Taliban. So, of course, Dexter goes ahead. He went into Pakistan for about a month and then called me up and said, okay, I think we have the access. So we were going to meet Haji Namdar, who was a big Taliban commander. And the night before we were leaving, Haji Namdar called and he said, you're welcome to come tomorrow, but the one thing you cannot do is bring a woman. So Dexter and I sort of looked at each other and said, well, we're not separating. And so Halim, who was one of our translators, said, oh, Mr. Dexter, can't you just take Miss Lindsay's camera and take pictures? We said, no, that's not the way it works for the New York Times. So he said, okay, I have an idea. No Taliban would leave his wife alone in a strange city, so you can be husband and wife, and you go together. We said, okay, we're husband and wife. We don't care. Just do whatever you have to do, and we're going together. So we dressed up in local clothes, and we drove to meet Haji Namdar. And, of course, the men got out of the car first and asked permission to bring me inside. And it's incredibly awkward because this is a part of the world, while incredibly hospitable, and if they invite you to visit them, they want to feed you and give you tea, and women don't leave the house. So it was very awkward, of course. I was veiled head to toe, but it was strange to even see a woman out of the house. So when I went in, it was a very small room with about 15 Taliban fighters and Haji Namdar. And I sat down behind Dexter, and Dexter said, hey, Haji Namdar, thank you so much for welcoming my wife. But, you know, my wife happens to have a camera. Do you mind if she takes some pictures? And I thought, wow, that's amazing that they're really going to believe that. So I started taking some pictures of Haji Namdar, and about 15 minutes go by, and suddenly everyone in the room gets a bit fidgety. And I thought, oh, of course, this is where they kill us. You know, we're Americans, we're visiting the Taliban. You know, we're worth a lot of money in this part of the world. So I sort of started getting nervous, and then a man comes over and he says, "Madam, we would like to serve you tea, but we don't know how you can drink the tea through your veil. So can you please go to the corner of the room, face the wall, lift your veil, drink your tea, and come back. Then you have our hospitality." So that was meeting the Taliban. And so these pictures were part of the 2009 Pulitzer Prize package. And this is in Swat Valley, where Malala Yousafzai is from. And I had heard that the Taliban was starting to close down girls' schools. And of course, with my experience in Afghanistan, that was something that was familiar to me because I remember visiting secret girls' schools in Afghanistan under the Taliban. So I snuck in, this time as my driver's wife, and went to some of these secret girls' schools, and it was right before Malala was shot. And this man said he wanted to go fight jihad against the Americans and kill Americans. So, of course, as a journalist, it's very awkward to be face-to-face and photographing a man who says he wants to kill Americans. In 2009, I started photographing women on the front lines of war, women in the military. This was before the Pentagon had lifted the ban on women on the front lines. But there were something called female engagement teams. The U.S. military sent women to southern Afghanistan to engage 50% of the population that they weren't engaging with men only. It was part of the Hearts and Minds campaign. And so I went with these women. For the first time, I wasn't the only woman. What you're looking at here is, you know, sometimes the female soldiers would go and Afghan women thought they were men because they were wearing helmets and flak jackets and pants. So the American women had to take off their helmet and say, "Look at my hair. See, I'm a woman like you." And so this was one of those incredibly incongruous moments. And here's Amy Zajac when I was doing that medevac embed and she was shaving her legs after a hard day's work. And a young woman watching Finding Nemo in her bunk. And so this was the first time, these instances were the first time I wasn't, you know, I could be with other women. And it was so great to have other women to talk to out in Afghanistan and in the field. There's Emily Nosland. She was a captain and very brave and a great Marine. And these are Afghan women training to be police. They're getting trained by Italian carabinieri. I've worked in Afghanistan now almost two decades. I haven't been in the last few years, but from 2000 till now. And one of the reoccurring themes I see is violence against women. Women have very, very difficult lives. There's a lot of physical and emotional abuse. This woman was married off at 12 years old to a man who couldn't walk. She was beaten almost daily by his brothers, and every day she had to bathe him and feed him and take care of him. Finally, when she was about 20 years old, she asked for a divorce because she just couldn't handle the life anymore. And they were so angry at her for having the audacity to ask for a divorce that they put her in prison, and this is where I met her. And this was for National Geographic's a big story I did on women in Afghanistan. In 2009, I won a MacArthur Fellowship, and I wanted to photograph maternal health and maternal mortality and why so many women were dying in childbirth in 2009. There were about 550,000 women dying every year in childbirth around the world, and Afghanistan had one of the highest rates. So I worked in very remote provinces. I was often in hospitals without electricity and in remote villages where midwives would go in for the day and do prenatal checks. And on the way back, I saw these two women on the side of the mountain. And anyone who knows Afghanistan knows that there's something wrong if there's not a man accompanying women, because in this part of the world, it's tradition for a man to always accompany women. And so we stopped the car and we jumped out and said, "What's going on? Why are you here?" And they said, "Well, Nornisa, the woman on the right, was in labor, and her water had just broken. And her husband's first wife died in childbirth. And he was so determined to not lose Nornisa in childbirth that he actually was able to get a car. But that car broke down. And so I saw them at that moment. And I turned to Dr. Ziba, my translator, and I said, 'Dr. Ziba, can you go find the husband?' And she said, 'I guess there's one road in the whole province.' And I said, 'Well, we should take them to the hospital.' And she said, 'Yes, but they need permission from the husband.' So she went and she found the husband. And the whole family piled in my car and I drove them the almost 3 hours to Faizabad. And Nornisa survived. She delivered safely. And I did not take pictures of the delivery, which many people ask me, did you shoot the delivery? And I didn't, because I felt like I really altered the story with my presence. So I only took about 4 or 5 frames that day, and National Geographic actually didn't choose this frame. They chose a different frame, but this is the one that I sort of begged and pleaded for in print, and I lost. In 2004, I started covering the war in Darfur, and the only way to get in to Darfur at that time was to sneak in through neighboring Chad. President Bashir of Sudan didn't want journalists there covering the war. So we walked for almost 2 miles and linked up with a truckload of rebels. These are rebels with the Sudanese Liberation Army. And we drove around the desert and witnessed villages that had been burned to the ground by the government. There were skeletons all across the desert. People fleeing for their lives. So we saw families literally making their way from the mountains in northwest Darfur all the way into Chad. And I covered Darfur for 6 straight years. Sometimes I was able to get a visa, sometimes I had to sneak in through Chad. But it was always difficult to get access to these villages. You know, there aren't traditional roads there, sometimes the roads are blocked, sometimes they're not safe. There are Janjaweed there, who are Arab men on horseback who were fighting on behalf of the government. So it was very complicated. We heard that this village had been bombed by the government. I was working with Lydia Polgreen for the New York Times, and we tried to get access to that village. We heard WFP, the World Food Program, had a helicopter going in to deliver food. So we went to the landing zone and we said, hey, we're with the New York Times, we heard about what happened, can we come and jump on the helicopter to get there? And they said, no, there are 8 seats on the helicopter, but no space for journalists, they're all WFP workers. And so Lydia went crazy, and she said, don't you understand the power of an image? And don't you understand that if you let my photographer on this helicopter, everyone will see what's happening in Darfur, and maybe you'll get more funding. And so the next day, the picture was on the front page of the New York Times, and WFP was very happy that they made space for one photographer. And to me, that was really the importance of documenting and being there and access. This is the aftermath of that, people waiting for the food that WFP was bringing. In 2008, we heard that Sudanese government soldiers had been massacred, and President Bashir went on TV and he said, no, that's a lie, no soldiers were killed. So Lydia and I were in Chad and we went to the border and we begged a truckload of rebels to take us to the massacre site because they said it did happen. So it was basically President Bashir's word against the rebels. So we went in, and as we got there, there were bodies clear across the desert. This picture was on the front page of the New York Times, and again, this was proof. This is the reality, and you cannot dispute what had happened. And so President Bashir had to backtrack. Darfur was the first place that a woman admitted to me of being raped as a weapon of war. It was in 2004. It was very brave. It's a story that I've gone back and covered over the course of my career. These are women in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where rape systematically happens to women as a part of the war happening there. This woman was enslaved. She was held for about 6 years, and both of those children were born out of rape. This is Ayak, a South Sudanese woman who was pregnant with her perpetrator's child. I met her in a safe house in Uganda and spent the weekend with her. And this picture was on the cover of Time magazine. When I photograph a woman in these very delicate situations, I really leave it up to the woman and often to a counselor working with the woman to help me decide what they feel comfortable with. This isn't a decision I make, it's really up to the woman and her counselor. So Ayak and I talked through this, and this is how she felt comfortable being portrayed. This woman had gout, and she couldn't flee when the government came to her village, so she was raped, and she did not want to show her face, so I photographed her feet. I continued the work on maternal mortality in Sierra Leone. This woman had very high blood pressure, which led to eclampsia. She had seizures during her birth and fell into a coma, and this is her mother feeding her. This is a woman whose sister Zainab had postpartum hemorrhaging, and so she bled after childbirth. And the hospital at Doctors Without Borders, they managed to keep Zainab alive for about a week while her sister sat by her bedside. I spent hours and hours with them over the course of that week, sitting and hoping and praying that Zainab would live. And this is the moment that Zainab died, and her sister just fell to the floor and fainted. I met Mama Cisse after she had delivered the first of twins. The second twin wouldn't come out. I met her when she had just come to the hospital after taking a canoe across a river to an ambulance and traveling 6 hours. One of the many reasons women die in childbirth in the world is because they cannot access a hospital or they can't get access to a doctor. At this time in Sierra Leone in 2010, there were 3 OBGYNs in the entire country. There was 1 doctor for this whole province. So when I realized that Mama Cisse was bleeding after childbirth, all of the midwives were focused on her baby. They were trying to get the newborn revived. So I went to try and find the doctor. When I went, he was in surgery. I put on scrubs. I went into surgery. I said, I think there's a woman dying. And he looked at me and said, well, you know, I'm busy. And so I left and I encouraged the women to take Mama Cisse to the doctor so that when he came out of surgery, she was right there. So they did, and in that moment, she died. And this is her funeral. So the one good thing that came out of the story is that Time magazine published an 8-page spread, and they also put on the video that I shot. It was not a very professional video because I didn't really have experience with video, but you can hear my voice saying, I think she's bleeding too much, and it was quite raw. And so Merck, the pharmaceutical company, someone at Merck saw that video, and they saw the 8-page spread. And his name was Dr. Naveen Rao, and he started showing the story to some of the board members at Merck. And one of the reasons why Merck for Mothers was started was because of this story. They put aside $500 million to fight maternal death based on this story. So that is one good thing that came out of Mama Cisse's death. In 2011, I wanted to cover the uprising in Libya. I'd missed the popular uprising in Egypt, and I asked if I can go. Like so many of the other wars I covered, I had to sneak in illegally. This time I went in through neighboring Egypt. And it was the only way to cover the uprising because Gaddafi wasn't giving visas to cover the uprising. So I went in and there were these very familiar signs of chaos. There was a call to arms. Doctors, teachers, engineers moved forward on the front line. They had no fighting experience, but we stayed with them and covered very heavy combat for about 2 weeks. On March 15th, 2011, it was still quite the beginning of the uprising. I was working in Ajdabiya with Tyler Hicks and Anthony Shadid and Stephen Farrell. We were all on assignment for the New York Times. And we knew that the city of Ajdabiya would fall. The signs were very clear. Civilians were fleeing en masse. Leaflets were being dropped from airplanes saying, get out of the city if you're not a fighter. And mortar rounds were walking onto our position. So we knew the front line was about to fall. As journalists, we have to make a decision as to how long to stay. We always want to stay till the last moment because you get the freshest story. So we went to the hospital, we were covering civilian casualties and literally counting the dead. Then we went back to the front line. Our driver got a call saying Gaddafi's troops had entered the city. For us, that was the biggest danger because we were there without visas. And Gaddafi had repeatedly said, journalists are all spies, and if you see a journalist, you should kill them. So by the time we made an exit to head east toward Benghazi, we ran directly into a checkpoint manned by Gaddafi loyalists. Immediately, our driver jumped out of the car and panicked and said, we're journalists, don't kill us. All the men were ripped out of the car. Bullets were flying everywhere because the rebels that we had been covering started opening fire on that checkpoint. I was the only woman, and I was sort of left in the back seat of the car. Often people don't know what to do with a woman in this situation, so I was sort of sitting there watching my colleagues through the window. I finally made a decision to crawl out the back seat of the car because I knew that our car wasn't armored and I had to get out of the way of the bullets. We made it to a cement building off to the side. We were told to lie face down in the dirt. Each one of us had a gun put to our heads. And we were about to be executed. I remember sort of saying prayers and looking to my right, and I saw all 3 of my colleagues literally looking up at the barrel of a gun, praying for their lives. At that moment, they decided not to execute us. They took my shoes off my feet, tied my ankles together and my wrists behind my back, and carried me away and placed me in a vehicle on the front line. I was punched in the face. From that moment, I was repeatedly threatened with execution. I was touched, I was groped, beaten, and we endured this, all of us, over the course of 6 days. And eventually, we were released into Tunisia. In 2015, I didn't want that experience to have me stop covering conflict. I still felt like the repercussions of war, refugees, so many of the issues I covered, humanitarian crises, women's issues, were still very important to cover. I did start going into Syria when the war in Syria started, but of course I was trying to navigate these stories as safely as I could. This is a story of the displaced that the New York Times Magazine did, where we followed three children displaced by war. And this is Chol, a South Sudanese boy. And this is Hana, a Syrian girl. And I've covered Syrian refugees for the last 7 years. I've been to northern Iraq, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, all the neighboring countries, covering the plight of Syrian refugees as they flee. Families at the border with Turkey. You know, a lot of what I'm trying to do is humanize Syrian refugees. We often, you know, refugees are often demonized. For me, they're mothers, they're daughters, they're people struggling to bring safety to their families. And so this was part of a year-long project for Time Magazine, where we followed three Syrian pregnant women through their final months of their pregnancy, through childbirth, and followed their newborns for 1 year. And this is Taima. And this is in a refugee camp in Greece, and Taima and her family are now in Estonia, where they were given asylum. I went into the Mediterranean and photographed Africans being plucked from the sea by the Italian Navy. These are people all looking for a better life. Some are escaping persecution by the government or oppression. Some are going for financial reasons. I ended up doing about 5 different rescue boats with the Belgian Navy, Italian Navy, with a private ship called MOAS, and with Doctors Without Borders. And this is them getting processed on the shores of Sicily. And most recently, my work has been in America. Well, with the exception of a recent trip to Yemen, which will be out tomorrow in the New York Times Magazine and in Sunday's Magazine. But I've been working along the border with Texas and Mexico, doing some border patrols for the New York Times. A lot of this work took place in the middle of the night and at dawn, and this is an agent chasing after a migrant right after he crossed. And I'm photographing Nick Kristoff and Cheryl Wudun's new book on poverty in America. So I've been traveling across the country covering issues of homelessness, race, drug addiction. This is a man as he overdosed in Baltimore. And I'll just end with some pictures of me on assignment. A lot of people don't know what goes into making a photograph. Sometimes we have to really gain the trust of locals. We have to blend in. A lot of these images show that. This is during the war in Iraq, in Kirkuk, in Fallujah, crossing illegally into Darfur. So we had to walk through rivers and walk through the desert. And we lived basically on the back of this truck for 5 days in Darfur. This is in southern Afghanistan with the female engagement teams and in the Korangal Valley. And I am the little one. And this is during elections. So that's it. I hope I leave you with the importance of photojournalism and being there to bear witness. So I'll be taking questions, if anyone has any questions.
I'd like to know what your family thinks of your adventures.
Yeah. So I didn't say much to my parents until the first time I was kidnapped, because they ended up getting a call from the New York Times in 2004 saying I had disappeared. So at that point, I kind of had to be a little more transparent about what I was doing. Of course, they were seeing in my pictures in the New York Times, but I think it's very hard to understand the dangers until something goes wrong. Now I'm married. I have an almost 7-year-old child. My husband was a journalist, so he understands what goes into telling these stories. And we talk about everything. We talk about, you know, every assignment I take, whether, you know, it was evaluating whether to go into Yemen in September. We talk about the dangers, and that is really important. You know, he asks me questions, he challenges me. Why do I need to go? What can I bring to a story that someone else can't?
So how do you feel about the president who says that journalists are the enemy of the people? How do you process that?
I have a fundamentally hard time with saying that journalists are the enemy of the people, because I myself have been kidnapped twice, and, you know, under regimes that said journalists are the enemy of the people. So it's a very dangerous starting point. If you say journalists are the enemy of the people, it basically gives people license to be violent against journalists. We've seen a newsroom gunned down. We've seen a journalist body checked, and the president applauds him. We have seen a Saudi journalist lured into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and murdered. You know, his body chopped up by, you know, all proof shows that it was ordered by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, who is our ally, and we still haven't condemned it. To me, if you start by saying journalists are the enemy of the people, you enable all of those other dictators and authoritarians around the world to continue disappearing and injuring journalists. And it's happening in our country. You know, it's perpetuating violence against journalism. So I think it's I have a very hard time with what's happening.
Hi.
Hi.
I have so many questions. So I guess I don't want to get too personal with
you.
You but
can. I don't care.
I guess I'm really curious about before you, you know, before this work was really successful, was there, like, for you, and it was, like, really what you were doing, and you were kind of on the cusp of, am I going to do this? Was there something in you that was fascinated with suffering or with kind of the beauty of the dark side of the human experience?
No.
Was that kind of part of who you were as a young girl?
No. I mean, first of all, I think people are very confused when they meet me, because I'm a very happy person by nature, and I'm always joking around, and I'm always sort of, I'm very positive. And so I think when people meet me, they assume I'll be covered in blood or depressed or say, you know, and I'm not. I'm just a happy person. And I think, you know, I had the greatest childhood. And, you know, there was nothing in my childhood that would have pointed to a career in a war, you know, in a series of wars. So I think it was curiosity that led me to a lot of these stories. And it was the need to understand if our perception from the outside matched the reality on the inside. And I wasn't drawn into war because it was violent and dark. I was drawn into these places because of the stories on the margins of war, how they affected civilians, women, and then inevitably I got pulled into the war. But I think, you know, it's really for me now kind of a mission, a way to give people a voice, to be able to go to places that are rife with so many injustices, you know, to show the world that what's happening, because the politicians and people in power don't often have the ability to go where I go because it's too unsafe. You know, they can't go and bear witness. So we have to do that as journalists. And hopefully people in positions of power are sensitive enough to understand what's happening and to react and to use that information in a constructive way to change policy or address policy.
How do you handle post-traumatic stress disorder yourself?
Yeah. I think it's a tough question because I think I come from a very solid family and a stable base. So on the surface, I'm pretty okay. Like, I don't have recurring nightmares. I don't have textbook signs of PTSD. Like, you know, I don't suffer from depression or sleeplessness, or I'm not angry. But I go through periods after a story, like in the Korangal Valley, where we spent 2 months getting mortared and shot at and then eventually getting ambushed, where I have a very hard time sort of re-entering. You know, I spent about a month where I couldn't get through the day without breaking down. I'd have to leave the dinner table and go lock myself in a bathroom and cry. And that doesn't really happen very much anymore. I think after Libya, you know, we were so grateful to be alive when our driver was killed that, you know, there was this sort of feeling of just being so grateful and relieved to have survived because we knew how lucky we were. But then two of my friends were killed about a month later, Tim Hetherington and Chris Hondros. And so that's when it hit me. That's when the trauma really hit me because it was like survivor's guilt. And then it was a series of questions of, wait, why did I live and they didn't? I don't understand. That's not fair. I should be dead. And then that's when I had a really tough time. And so for me, I talk about things very openly. I talk to my loved ones. I talk to my family. I have a great family. I have a great husband. And I exercise a lot, which I think helps. It sounds superficial, but to me, it's really sort of a form of meditation.
Are there photographers that you have been influenced by or inspired by?
I mean, there are so many. And they're not necessarily war photographers. I mean, they're of course, Jim Noctaway, who is still working, was a huge influence. But then there's like Sally Mann, Mary Ellen Mark, Diane Arbus. There are photographers who weren't. You know, then there are sort of my contemporaries, maybe women who are a little older than me, but still working, like Carol Guzzi. She's won 4 Pulitzer Prizes, Washington Post photographer. Carolyn Cole, who's great, you know, so I think I take, you know, I'm constantly looking at work and trying to learn and trying to learn what a powerful photo is.
What is different about being a photographer today than in 2000 when you started, especially as a woman photographer?
I think as a woman, you know, it's always been an asset for me. You know, I've always been able to access men and women. I've physically just trained so I can keep up with the men, especially in war zones, so I make sure I'm strong. I work mostly in the Muslim world where those societies are often segregated by gender, so I'll have access to women and men. So for me, it's always been an asset. I think what's different today than, you know, in 2000 is when I started out in 2000, we used to sort of proudly paint, you know, tape the words TV on our car and journalist on our flak jackets and tell everyone, you know, hey, I'm an American journalist. I mean, I don't tell anyone I'm American anymore, and I do not say I'm a journalist, and I walk around as low profile as I can because journalists are targets now in ways that they were not in 2000, and governments can kill with impunity. And we saw that with Marie Colvin. We've seen it, you know, over and over with journalists.
Your photos are absolutely beautiful, and you capture the emotion, just stunning.
Thank you.
My question is, for your book, how do you get the model releases for people, or is it because you're working for, you know, all the magazines and that?
Sure. You don't get model releases for editorial, just for your information. But before I take a picture, I spend a lot of time with people. And I explain what I'm doing. You know, I interview them. I get their permission before I even take my cameras out. So I think it's very important to do that because a lot of the people I photograph, there could be repercussions from being photographed. And I need to make sure that they understand that their picture might end up on Facebook. You know, that's something they all know is Facebook. And so, you know, I have to have very detailed conversations before I shoot, especially in places like Afghanistan, where a woman could be killed for allowing her picture to be taken without the permission of her husband and brother and father.
You mentioned video. Do you see yourself as doing more video in the future?
You know, I am not that coordinated. I would like to. I mean, I think, you know, for me, really powerful multimedia pieces have a still, audio, video. I love the combination. But I, you know, when I was in Yemen in September, I shot some sort of video portraits. And we will see what goes up on the New York Times site tomorrow or Thursday, whenever they put it up. But I've encouraged them to use some of those clips because I do think they add a layer to the story. But I can't really do both effectively simultaneously. So I can do like video portraits, but I can't do a full video and shoot stills.
Thank you for being here. It's very meaningful that you're here presenting today. I was curious what you know or think about the plight of freelance journalists who aren't supported possibly by big publications as you have been. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you have colleagues or know people who are on their own and how the dangers are magnified especially.
Sure.
So can you speak to that, please?
Yeah, I think... you know, I've been freelance my whole life. So for the first sort of 4 or 5 years of my career, I couldn't get an assignment to save my life, you know, and I was saving my money and sending myself to Afghanistan. I think it's a different world now. Like what we talked about, there's ISIS, there's Al-Qaeda, there's kidnappings. People have learned the value of Western journalists. So I would not encourage a freelancer to go into Syria, for example, to work in these places where journalists are intentionally targeted, because I think you know, you need the backing of a publication to sort of have your back when something goes wrong. But, you know, in my 20s, I'd never had that. So I'd be hypocritical to say don't go, because, of course, you have to go to get the experience. What I would say is probably start in places that aren't the most dangerous. You know, there are places to work all over Africa and in many parts of the Middle East where, you know, you can tell really important stories and not be targeted.
Hi.
Hi.
So kind of going off that, by you said that you did kind of fall into Afghanistan, you were able to send yourself there first. When did it become evident that you needed more physical, like hands-on medical or training? So like, how do you keep up physically with your assignments?
I mean,
and keep with safety.
I think the physical toll of this job is a lot. I mean, I have major, major back problems from 23 years of, you know, carrying around 60 pounds of gear and jumping out of helicopters and flak jacket and helmet and getting thrown out of a car on a highway. I think for me, you know, training and making myself strong has always been a very integral part of being a good photojournalist, because, you know, for many years I was doing a lot of military embeds and I couldn't say like, hey, can you guys wait for a minute while I, you know, I mean, you can't, you have to keep up and, you know, you're in really dangerous situations. So for me, it's always been intuitive that being physically fit was a very important part of this job. Just because of the sheer weight of the cameras and the gear and how much we have to train. Sure. So when I started out, those training courses were like $5,000 for the week. And of course, I couldn't ever afford it. And then by the time I started making any money, you know, in 2003 and 2004, I had already been kidnapped. So I thought, okay, well, there are these risk courses that journalists can take of like how to navigate dangerous situations. So I then, the New York Times, who I often work for in war zones, often has security advisors that come and live in the houses with us. And so they give us sort of basic first aid, how to stop bleeding, how to deal with, you know, a car accident, how to put on a, you know, to stabilize, you know, someone. So we would have those sort of trainings in the bureau. Recently, a few years ago, after Tim and Chris were killed, not right after, but probably 2013, I went and took a course in England. So I think those courses should be out there and available, especially for people who can't afford them, because I think they do tend to be expensive and it's hard for freelancers.
Hi, I was just wondering if there was ever a story like the one you spoke on earlier, that you felt the publication didn't either do justice to or you didn't feel advocated for the situation enough? And if that happens more often than you would like, and how do you handle that kind of occurrence?
I mean, there have been stories, there have been stories. The Korngal Valley was a tough story. That kind of got, You know, sometimes it depends on sort of when they come out. It depends on how long the writer takes to write them. It depends on how busy the editor is when it's time to close a story. So sometimes they don't always get the attention that we would want. It also depends on what other news is happening in that week, you know. So I think, for example, you know, we have midterms coming up, and there's a lot of domestic news. We have the recent attacks in Pittsburgh. We have, you know, the pipe bombs. We have so much happening in America that, you know, I have a huge story on Yemen that I risked my life to go and tell, and I'm not sure anyone will pay attention, but that still doesn't stop me because I think it's really important, and it'll be there whenever anyone is ready to look at it.
How do you reconcile putting yourself in life-threatening situations with the possibility that you could leave your child motherless?
So the reason why I waited until I was 38 to have a child was because I knew that would be a difficult thing to reconcile. So I basically just didn't have a child. At some point after Libya, after I had been kidnapped twice and started losing friends, my husband, it was always very important for him that we started a family, and for me too, but I kept thinking, well, I can do it later and later and later. So now, of course, my child is almost 7, and it is hard. It's hard to go to Yemen. It's hard to go to northern Nigeria. It's hard, you know, look, something can happen to us in America. You know, there's a lot of issues with guns in America. So I don't necessarily, you know, anything can happen anytime, but it's scary, you know. It's hard, but I also believe in doing this work, and I believe that men with children do this work all the time. They don't get judged, and I need, you know, I have the ability to tell these stories, and I have to do that. And I have a great husband who's the like an amazing father, so he would be in good hands, unfortunately.
When were you the most scared?
Libya. I mean, there's not even a question. You know, I think in Libya, from the minute we were taken until we crossed into Tunisia, I was not sure we would live. So it was repeated physical, psychological abuse and torture, and a lot of fear, a lot of you know, helplessness, and a lot of unknowns. And so it was for sure, you know, almost a week of terror. So on that note, I'll be signing books.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.